Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The challenge you face if you try to describe the von Habsburgs, perhaps the most famous family in European history, is not turning the description into, however fascinating, a long and intricate journey back through 1,000 years of our common history. They began in Austria, acquiring a castle first in 1020, and then becoming the house or the family that ruled over the Holy Roman Empire, and along the way, providing kings for Bohemia, Hungary, Croatia, Spain, Portugal, Galicia, Lodomeria, with their respective colonies, rulers of several principalities in the Low Countries and Italy, and of course in the 19th century, emperors of Austria and Austria-Hungary, as well as one emperor of Mexico. I vividly remember my excitement when I bumped into a neighbour, an elderly film director who'd become a friend in Sussex some years ago. I was astonished to discover that his surname was von Habsburg, and immediately I wanted to know just how close he was to the succession. If ever the Holy Roman Empire was restored, how close was he to being Holy Roman Emperor? He put up with my rather late adolescent fanzine questioning and reminded me of quite how complex such a famous family had become. And recently I met another von Habsburg, this time online, who was publicly very well known since he'd been appointed to be Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See, Edward Habsburg. Edward has a vivid and vigorous online presence, writing on Twitter and elsewhere, captivating things about Hungary, about the Holy See, and about the Catholic Church, always with wit, depth, and charm, a combination that you'll recognise immediately as being very rare on social media. And recently he's written an entertaining and very accessible book, both about being a Habsburg and also about being a Catholic. It's called The Habsburg Way, subtitled Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. And the seven rules are: get married, be Catholic, believe in the empire, stand for law and justice, know who you are, be brave in battle, and die well. Not all the chapters work out as you expect, but all of them are captivating. Edward agreed to come and talk to me about his book, which you can get online and from all good bookshops, and so his family too: European history, the Catholic faith, and the challenge of our present times. One of the most striking aspects of our conversation is that it ended on a powerful and unusual note of optimism, and I found myself greatly cheered. You may want to listen right to the very end. And so here is Edward von Habsburg, ambassador on behalf of the Hungarian government to the Holy See. Edward Habsburg, so nice to meet you. Thank you for joining. I've been following you on Twitter and enjoying enormously your contribution to public debate. You're Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See. Some people will know what that means. Lots of people won't. Could you explain, first of all, where you are in the Habsburg dynasty? I have a friend of yours called Francie in Rottingdean. And so from him, over bottles of wine, I've learned a little bit about your family. But can you tell us where you are in the family and what you do as ambassador to the Holy See?
Okay, the first part is usually a 20-minute conversation involving paper and pen and huge family trees. But I will give you the short version, the executive summary version of it. There is four major branches in the Habsburg family. All of those split apart at the beginning of the 19th century, more or less. Four grandchildren, or the grandchildren of Maria Theresia, children of Leopold II. That's where the four major branches of the Habsburg family moved apart. And I would be part of the Hungarian branch of the family. If you ask me distance from the throne...
Everyone wants to know how close you are to being the Holy Roman Emperor, should circumstances change.
If I want to become Holy Roman Emperor, I would have to kill about 70 or 80 Habsburgs. I am the eldest son of the penultimate Habsburg. So I'm really from a minor line, the kind of family line where you usually offer them rules in distant places, but I would never be emperor. So we're from the Hungarian branch, and that also builds the bridge to my cousin that you know. He's also from the Hungarian branch, and to the fact that I'm Hungarian ambassador to the Holy See. My father was born in Hungary, then became a refugee and lived all over Europe, but I always was Hungarian. And when the Hungarian government was looking for a new ambassador to the Holy See, they reached out to me. And I told them, you got the wrong guy. I write screenplays. I have even written a screenplay for a zombie movie. I'm not the ambassador type. And then we began talking. And I also had very wrong ideas about what an ambassador does. I imagined them standing around with a glass in their fingers, holding the glass limpidly and trying not to say anything wrong and smiling all the time, which is nothing to do with what you do. Being ambassador is incredibly exciting, incredibly fulfilling. 90% of what you do in the shadows. You can never talk about it, of course, but it's absolutely wonderful. And being ambassador of Hungary to the Holy See is especially exciting because Hungary, of course, as you know, has a certain reputation in Europe. We're sometimes seen as the bad boys for our positions that sometimes are not being seen kindly in the rest of Europe. And explaining that to representatives of the Holy See is always lots of fun.
I can imagine it is, and people have to have a sense of history. But it's only really in the last 20 years, as the European Union began to have ambitions that perhaps in its origins, its founding fathers wouldn't have easily recognized. It's only then that Hungary has been seen as not playing along because its position has been principled, pragmatic, and honorable. The bad boy thing is only because you're standing out against the bullies, isn't it?
Well, Gavin, that's very kind of you. It's something we hear rather rarely in Europe. But what I would say is I would quote my Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, who, when he met the Pope here in Rome, afterwards he gave a talk here in the garden of the other embassy. And he said, if Adenauer, Schumann and De Gasperi, the founders of the European Union, would come back today, where would they find the European values? In Brussels or in Central Europe? And we often are accused that we don't share European values anymore, but it may be the other way around.
Yes, I think it is. And so I'm glad you said that. And I'm glad Viktor Orban said that. And so thank you for clarifying that. We're going to have lost half our listeners straight away, but we'll gain another more sympathetic and a better educated half, those who understand a bit of history. And if you don't understand a bit of history and you're sitting uncomfortably, just hang on and you'll learn a thing or two as we continue this conversation. That's where you live in the dynasty. And being an ambassador, obviously, well, first of all, you've shown the skills that an ambassador requires in the way you've answered all the questions so far. What does the Holy See want from an ambassador? Is it information? Is it a conduit of communication? What do you give them?
First of all, the Vatican is a place where you still have classical diplomacy. You try to influence the opinion of the Holy See on Hungary. You try to friendly influence the opinion of the other ambassadors on Hungary. You inform your government what the Pope and the Holy See are up to and why. It's always a two-way street. You always pass on information in both directions. My job is to keep the information between the two states, between the Holy See and Hungary. That usually doesn't require much work. Sometimes it's organizing visits. Sometimes it's helping both sides clarifying misunderstandings, mostly about church property and such boring things. Very rarely there is real drama. I haven't really had a real drama in the last years. And then, of course, you do try to convince the Pope to come to your country, which very surprisingly he's done twice now. He's come to Hungary 21 in September, and he's coming again end of April, where he's going to visit our country for 3 days. So this, of course, I love to boast that this is all my doing, which is of course, not. I think that the Pope for many years was very eager to come and visit Hungary. I know this from several conversations with different people. And he was just waiting for the right moment. The right moment seems to have come. And an ambassador is just a tiny wheel in the whole great machinery.
Well, clearly, an ambassador has to be both humble and effective, and you seem to have managed both yet again. So, I mean, two papal visits, that really is pretty efficient. So congratulations, even though quite clearly you had nothing to do with it.
Also, Gavin, one of the jobs of the ambassador to the Holy See is to try to figure out which 3 to 6 topics the Holy See in Hungary strongly agree upon. And as most journalists would probably think that Hungary and Holy See are at loggerheads about everything. Well, that's absolute nonsense, of course. And one of your jobs is to find the topics that you agree upon, further them, work on conferences, mutual project on that. And I've been doing this for seven years now. So when the Pope meets with Orban, they really engage on topics that they work together for. So it's a fun job. I'm here with, unfortunately, now only two of my six children that still are with us. And of course, my wife. It's the greatest thing I've ever done in my life.
I'm not surprised. Let's go off piste a little bit, but only because I think you may be able to say genuinely to say things that would help people. I'm a Europhile. I speak a couple of European languages, one well, one horrifically. I spend some of my life writing in France, but I'm not a supporter of the European Union, as my earlier remarks show, partly again, because I think that the original vision isn't compelling the imagination and the allegiances of the present political class. Now, Hungary has stood out against this change. What are the culture wars like in Hungary? I'm not asking you for a political broadcast. You wouldn't give it to me anyway, quite rightly. But we're so used in the West of Europe to struggling incompetently with the culture wars. Whatever view one takes, whether you're for or against them, one looks over at Hungary and there is a sense of allegiance to a cultural stability. Does this come from the Hungarian character, its experiences of the last 50 years, its experiences of the last 500 years? Why is it that Hungary seems to, in my value system, which is partisan, retain a degree of sanity and stability, whereas the rest of Europe can't tell whether a man is a woman or a woman is a man and would rather have equality and diversity than economic competence? Where does Hungary get this, what I would call a whiff of common sense from?
I would say you've gave all the answer in your question, as every really good interviewer should do. I would say you're leading me, but you don't, because you obviously are on target. It's the Hungarian character, I think. Hungarian character shaped by the last 1,000 years of history. And for a long, long time in those 1,000 years of history, Hungary was occupied or felt menaced by other forces. Hungary was occupied by Islamic forces for 150 years in the 16th, 17th century. Large parts of Hungary were under Muslim rule then. After that, in the view of the Hungarians, it was occupied, under scare quotes, by the Habsburgs. And what happened in Hungary was decided in Vienna. After that, it was the Russians or the communist world that oppressed Hungary. And when Hungary finally emerged from all of this after 1989, I think there was a strong feeling of someone from outside won't tell us anymore what we should do. We are Hungarians. We're a proud people. We want liberty and we want to decide on our fate. So when Hungary is confronted with strong interference from outside, they usually get nervous. Some people say Hungary has a tendency to live with their back towards the border. That also helps. You won't be influenced by the latest fad easily. The Hungarians know very clearly what they want, what they believe in, and which principles they stand for. If you participate as a very proud nation in a conglomeration of nations like the European Union, you will only do so if you're strongly respected. This is more or less what Emperor Charles V told his son in a letter, where he says, if you rule over several countries, you have to, I won't say damn well, respect their habits, their rights, their special legal situation, their languages, their character, and their differences, or you'll be in deep trouble. And we live in a time where we sometimes have the impression that the European Union wants to centralize everything. But Europe doesn't work that way. Hungary will always react like that when you run over their toes. And when a central institution tries to mingle in how we do our things in Hungary, then the Hungarians will stand up and fight. And Viktor Orban is basically all of this. This is what he stands for because his people think like that. He's not one of those leaders that seem to get their ideas from above and then pass them down. But he's someone who is very much in sync with what his population thinks, what his basis thinks. And that's the politics he makes.
Help me with a question, and it's born of ignorance. I'm not leading you. This has elements of subsidiarity in it. And so it occurs to me that there are several different kinds of subsidiarity. There's going to be cultural and existential and political and administrative subsidiarity. Is that what we're talking about here? That if you like, the European Union has within its DNA a commitment to administrative subsidiarity.
Article 5 of the European Union is...
Right, yes. But it doesn't seem to stretch towards cultural or existential subsidiarity. Is that a proper distinction, or is this not the right way to go to understand the tensions that produce this kind of disagreement?
Well, I just feel that there is a tendency right now to overreach from the center of Europe that may be also cultural. If I go back into my book, what I say in my book, The Habsburg Way, and if you read the introduction by Viktor Orban, that he generously contributed to that book, you will see that in history, it was really Hungary that taught the Habsburgs how to be subsidiaric when they forgot about it. The Habsburg history from the 13th century, they never had the temptation to be evil rulers winning over countries with armies, because they couldn't. As Holy Roman Emperor, you were from the beginning, you had to juggle between many different nationalities, many different legal systems, and it was a very complicated balancing act. And that remained the Habsburg DNA for centuries. Then when the Habsburgs only ruled over Austria-Hungary and neighboring countries, it became the DNA of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But there were a few moments when the Habsburgs very strongly cracked down and decided to become centralistic. That was under Joseph II. Joseph II decided, why do we need a crown in Budapest? Why do we need a crown in Prague? Why do we need different languages? We have one empire. We have a center in Vienna. Everybody speaks German, and that's it. So he did all that. He took away all the lower level powers, and that led to uproar and to problems and to drama, because it's not what we are. And the Hungarians helped the Habsburgs to understand that. So, yes, I'm very hopeful for the European Union, because in Central Europe, there is great enthusiasm for the European Union, not just because, as they always say, because of the money we get from the European Union, but there is a real passion. If you make polls in Hungary or in Poland, there is a real passion for the European Union. But we just feel that there is room for improvement in the way that we treat each other.
Well, if the Hungarians have managed to educate the Habsburgs, perhaps they can manage to educate Macron and the bureaucrats of Brussels as well. They've done it once, why not twice? Let me go back and let's talk about your book, The Habsburg Way, which with its seven virtues, which I enjoyed very much, and it's perfectly proper to use our conversation as a way of commending it to one. It's a wonderful read. So I didn't know, I should have known that you were a scriptwriter, but it shows in the style. It's excellent. But I thought to myself as I came to it, this is going to be a hard sell, because in cultural terms, you're really struggling against the tide. The tide is egalitarian, it's identitarian, it's democratic, notionally at any rate. And here you are defending one of the most emblematically problematic institutions in history, and you do it very well. And the reason you do it well is not only because of the skill you bring to it, but because implicitly, most of the time, sometimes explicitly, you present it with its Christian credentials. In other words, power is tempered by compassion and responsibility. Ambition is tempered by love and compassion. Realpolitik is tempered by saints in the family. And you manage to show the virtues of what happens when Christianity begins to infect the state. I was just listening to this is a rabbit hole, we won't go there, but I was listening to a lecture on Shakespeare and the Catholic faith. One of the things that the lecturer was saying was that King Lear was written to show James what a country would be like if there was no Christianity in the DNA. And of course, it's an immensely bleak picture, both of the personal task and the political task. And what you've done is the opposite to Lear. You've shown what history looks like when the people who rule it are accountable to Christian values. And I thought not only was it well done in terms of defending your family, but obviously you'd want to do that, but it was a very important project just at this moment when Europe is slipping away from the gravitational virtuous pull of faith. How did you find it as a balancing act while you wrote?
The idea for this book came over the last 2 years. And as you perhaps recall, there was this tiny thing that happened in the last 2 or 3 years that made many people very, very suspicious of their leadership, of politics. Many people felt that they probably haven't been told all the truth about things, had measures put upon them that may have in some cases been overdone and without any regard for their freedom. So I asked myself in my book, what are those virtues that I believe in many cases in my family existed in the rulers? Why did they consistently exist over centuries in this family? Why did Habsburg rulers try to be just, try to be devout, try to respect tradition? Why did they stand for family values? Why did they live their faith toward the monk? I realized that many of these things aren't around anymore. One example is, for instance, I give you one tiny example. Blessed Emperor Karl, the last Habsburg ruler, a man that by in the eyes of a purely secular historiography was a total loser. He took over the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the last 1.5 years of a war that one was losing. And in the end, the war was lost, the empire was over, and he was gone after 1.5 years to die on an island in exile after 2 failed attempts to return. This is the ultimate image of losing. But then you learn about the way he died. And then you learn about his daily life. And then you learn about what he was to his children. And then you learn how he fought, desperately fought for peace in a time where everybody else yelled war. And then you learn that he offered his life for his people in exile. He offered his life to God for his people in exile. And he suffered through weeks and weeks of illness in bed, slowly getting worse, having horrible pain. And he offered all of this up for his people. And I asked myself, that was the moment where I said, do we have a politician who would do that nowadays? And why not? And then I thought, we should ask for politicians of that kind. We should ask this. We should want to know what are the values that a politician can be measured at. Does a politician believe that when he dies, he will stand in front of God and has to be accountable to God for what he did or not? We had rulers who had this job for life and whose decisions would weigh upon their children. We have politicians that do politics for a while and then use this as a jumping board into business where they can earn a lot of money and have no more responsibility for the countries. So I sort of felt there something is gone. And funnily enough, because you said at the beginning that I'm defending an institution, you, of course, talked about monarchy in a way, not just the Habsburg family. But I, in my talks with American friends, I always say America has no tradition of monarchy. Those 7 rules are applicable everywhere where people live and where states are and where families are. You don't need to be a monarchist to implement them. But of course, there is always the question, how could a monarchy be if it would be a really Catholic monarchy nowadays? And how different would that be of what we sometimes see in monarchies nowadays? And is that even possible in the world of today? But the book is not an advertisement for monarchy. It is an advertisement, I think, for living a Christian way and in a responsible way.
Yes, no, it's not at all promoting monarchy per se. What it's doing is promoting Christianity and particularly the Catholic faith. What you outline is what happens to an institution. We all know what institutions are capable of, both in terms of good and bad. And what you do in the book is you outline what happens to an institution when it's captured by faith and captured by Catholicism. You know, that then throws up, it ought to throw up the issue for philosophers, for people with ethical consciences, about why it would be so difficult for a monarchy to be a Christian today. In England, we're certainly facing that at the moment, because without wanting to take our conversation away from the Habsburgs, bring me back quickly. But nonetheless, we find ourselves with a monarchy that's faced with those 2 choices. Should we be more Christian against the flow of culture, or less Christian and go with culture to please people? It's chosen to go with culture. And my judgment is that it won't survive because of it. Whereas the Habsburgs continually made a choice for the virtues of faith and for Christianity, and above all, for the church that Jesus founded. And they were remarkably successful at the same time. Jesus talks about that, seek first the kingdom of heaven and you'll get everything else alongside. So the Habsburgs appeared to seek the kingdom of heaven and they produced 1,000 years of benign rule, obviously with occasional exceptions. The book itself is a study in the conflict between power and faith and has some wonderful anecdotes. One of my favorite was Magdalena and the role that this very powerful woman of faith played at a critical moment in European history. Anyone with a woman like that in their DNA chain could be very proud.
Yes. Well, Magdalena of Habsburg lived in the 16th century, about the time of the Council of Trent. Magdalena decided that she wanted to become a nun or at least found a monastery. And her father was absolutely against it. Ferdinand I, brother of Charles V, and was very much set against it. He said, one of your younger sisters who are weak, they can become nuns, but not you. I want to marry you off, of course. She was beautiful, and there's a painting by Archimboldo of her. So If you get painted by Archimboldo, you're an archduchess, daughter of the emperor. It's not bad. But she had a vocation. She was strongly influenced by Petrus Canisius of the Jesuit order, saint. And, well, she tried. She persisted, and finally her father allowed her to go ahead and found a monastery in Hall in Tyrol. She did that with two of her sisters, and she was very devout, very pious, also very intelligent, very, very closely following the Council of Trent. The Habsburg Empire, in the meanwhile, was really heavily in danger from Reformation. And on the throne of the Habsburgs was Maximilian II, and he was a brother of Magdalena. And he had a Protestant educator, and he had a Luther Bible on his desk. And unfortunately, I have to say, he stopped going to Mass after half of his reign. So not exactly a strong example in Catholic faith in a time where the Habsburg lands were overrun by Protestant preachers. And everybody seemed to accept that it was more or less over for Catholicism in the Habsburg world. And that was the moment when the nuncio of the Pope arrived in Austria and wanted to encourage the Habsburgs to begin with counter-reformation after the Council of Trent. But he knew he couldn't go to Maximilian, so he went to Magdalena in a monastery and told her, what do I do? And Magdalena put her together with two other of her brothers, the Habsburg that ruled in Graz, the Habsburg that ruled in Tyrol, and her sister, who was married to the Bavarian prince. And together, they made a meeting in Munich in 1578, I think. It was called the Münchner Abkommen, and they hammered out an action plan to take back the Habsburg lands for the Catholic faith. It's a bit like, you know, when Boy Scouts get together and make a plan. It was like, it's a list of things to do, you know, encourage your bishops to put back courageous priests, throw out your Protestant advisors and put in Catholics, hook up with the nuncio of the Pope and discuss everything with him. It was wonderful. But in fact, it was because of her and her brothers and her sister Bavaria that Catholic faith returned to the Habsburg lands, while we had a very weak emperor in Vienna. And her nephew was then another Ferdinand. And because of her family ties, he studied in Bavaria at the Jesuit university and school where his aunt lived. He was a boy that got up in the morning and said his prayers on his knees and went to Mass every day. When he was a young man, he made a pilgrimage to Loreto and promised Our Lady to make Austria Catholic again. And finally, he, by a series of circumstances, became Emperor Ferdinand II, champion of Catholic faith in the 30-year war. So all of this was set in motion by this strong, beautiful, and upright Catholic woman, Magdalena Habsburg, who is the only other venerable we have in the family. We have, of course, Blessed Emperor Karl, but she was declared venerable in the beginning of the 20th century, which was, to go back to the Catholic mafia and the Habsburg family, a common project of Blessed Emperor Karl of Austria and of Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne that was shot to death in Sarajevo in 1914. Very devout man too, very devout man, a man that lived the Sacred Heart devotion. And he had begun the whole process of beatification for Magdalena. And I mean, I hope one day we will rediscover her as a saint. That's typical Habsburg. On the border between faith, politics, networking and family values, turning around Habsburg history.
Well, that's why this is such a good book, because it contains history, philosophy, anecdotes, and a philosophical and theological route map through the human condition.
The book has several instances where Habsburgs are at the crossroad, where they can choose between go with the flow and save your empire, and stubbornly go against the flow and risk everything. And one of these is, in fact, Ferdinand II, the one I just talked about. Henry Kissinger, in his book Diplomacy, he writes about Cardinal Richelieu. And Cardinal Richelieu, basically, why being a Catholic cardinal? For him, everything was allowed for the reason of the state. You can do deals with the devil just to save the state. And he writes in his book that he can't understand why Ferdinand II, when he was emperor, didn't give some concessions to the Protestant princes. With a little gesture, he would have had peace in the empire and everything would have been fine. But no, he stubbornly had to insist on the Catholic privileges and fight the Protestant ones. And that's the difference. That's the difference between Richelieu and Ferdinand II. Ferdinand II once famously said, when he enforced Catholic faith in his countries, if I wouldn't care for my subjects, I would let them go wherever they want, but I want them to go to heaven. And that's why I fight so strongly for Catholic faith. Now that's a ruler that's Catholic.
And somehow these people make so much more of an impact on us. Frederick II is remembered better than Richelieu is. It reminds me of Thomas More, who was dealing with the same kind of ethical issues and is burned into European consciousness as a man of great principle that politically he lost, philosophically, spiritually, he won. You may have answered my question already, but having asked you to talk about Magdalena, I was going to ask you who your favorite ancestors are.
Well, if you go on Twitter now, you can vote in my online poll. I began a championship of Habsburgs right now. Offer four Habsburgs and then you can vote and two of them make it to the next round. So over the next weeks, we'll find out what my Twitter followers like. I can tell you, I did a poll in our Habsburg WhatsApp group, among our family members.
That just sounds... What a fantastic combination. Who would have ever thought there could be a Habsburg WhatsApp group? The world is a better place for knowing that such a thing exists. You asked the question in the group. What did they say?
Well, I said I want only to hear from the younger Habsburgs. What's your favorite Habsburg? And I expected something like Franz Joseph or Empress Elizabeth Sisi, that everybody thinks is beautiful, and or Maria Theresia. But all of them, nearly all of the young ones, went for Blessed Emperor Karl.
Really?
As I say, this young man that was only emperor for 1.5 years and in the eyes of the world lost, but was a humble giant of faith, as I called him. And I asked one of my nieces, why him? And they said, because he, in his vocation, husband, in his job, emperor, and in his faith life as a Catholic, he strove for perfection. And he really tried to be good in everything he did. And while I wrote the book, you know, I have this system that I say, this is the 7 rules, the 7 principles of our family. And while I was writing the book, I always find examples for each of those 7 principles of the family. And there are 2 or 3 Habsburgs over the century that incorporate many more than 1 or 2 or 3 of these principles. There's always the same names that come back. And in the end, Blessed Karl stands for all seven of them. He incorporated all of this. He died well. He was brave in battle. He was personally in the war and fought battles. He knew who he was. He stood for tradition. He stood strongly for law and justice. He believed in subsidiarity. He was Catholic. Well, and he was married and had lots of children and a wonderful, happy marriage. So, yeah, I can understand why Blessed Karl is, for many of our younger Habsburgs, the great idol in the family. But I'm trying to, with my book, to encourage the younger generation to discover all the others that we have, because we have quite a few good ones, 1 or 2 or 3 that are rather horrible, but even those had good sides.
So if I'd been a better interviewer, I would have given you the platform to give us the 7 rules, but you've just done it, working backwards. Do you have hope for the future generations of Habsburgs? What is your sense in terms of the way in which our culture and our civilization is so delicately poised. Very often when I'm talking about the difficulty that the Catholic faith and the Christian faith have in Europe, I say, well, you know, Europe has been Christian for a long time, but it's given up on its principles, and therefore it's going to lose its soul to some extent. But never mind. China, Asia, Africa, there's an outbreak of Christianity there. Help me with my pessimism about the way in which Europeans have let go of perhaps the most important element in our history, this gift of a soul given to us through the experience of the Incarnation and the Apostolic Church. I won't ask you why we've let it go. That's a complicated question, and we know the stock answers to it. But what are the possibilities of retaining our faith as a European enterprise and culture?
Well, that's the big question, Gavin. That's the big question. I would say, if you look at Europe right now, it looks bleak. You see in many places something of a cemetery of values, of faith, of family, of all these things that Europe stands for. But I would say it's very easy. The means are easy, and the means are something everybody can do. If you live your faith and you live your sacraments and you strive for personal sanctity as far as it's possible for you, if you found families and you are generous enough to have many children, if these families are friends with other families with many children who live their faith, this is the nucleus from which the faith will rise again in Europe. This is how Christianity became the force that changed Europe through many, many families, through many, many Christians who lived their faith, who sacrificed their faith for others. It's not ridiculous to believe that this will come back. Wherever I meet faith communities that strongly live their faith, whose children grow up being Catholic, believing in family and these things, I see the future of Europe. And I have to make a little jump across the Atlantic and say that I made a few trips to the States now. The United States are the main target of this book. I've written it for the United States, most of all, for American readers. And America, funnily enough, represents a lot of these values, especially subsidiarity. America is not a centralistic continent. America is a nation of states that have many, many rights still on a local level. Americans are grassroots people. Americans in their heart are in the homestead and maximum in the township. I believe that this is the healing of Europe will come from the grassroots, will come from the bottom, will come from the families, will grow. A journalist once said that in a church, the church walls are crumbling and the ivy is everywhere, but in the shadow, the mushrooms grow mightily. I have a lot of hope. I have a lot of hope. Because God is the master of history. I can experience faith and the reemergence of faith in so many places that I've traveled to that I'm full of hope. I'm full of hope. We have to be. We're Christians.
This has been very interesting because I think it's the first time in a conversation like this that I've had the family presented to me in such a coherent and a cogent way. Looking back over the way in which Europe became Christianized, I at least have become overused to thinking in terms of monks and clergy, obviously holy monks and holy clergy and holy kings sometimes and serendipity. But this is the first time, and it's very welcome, to hear the Holy Family, our holy families, as opposed to the archetypal Holy Family as well, praised in this way. And it strikes me that you're right. And of course, at a spiritual level, I wonder if that's why the family is under such metaphysical attack. It's almost as if every possible weapon that a decadent and rebellious culture can throw against our civilization and our faith is aimed at the nature of the family. And perhaps that's why it's all the more important for us to be able to be clear-sighted and clear-minded and to do this not in the sense as people suspect that we do, of having old-fashioned morals we want to cling to out of a sense of nostalgia, but as you have done, to do it because you have a clear-eyed forensic analysis of where the real power of the spiritual condition lies. And that's very helpful. Thank you.
That was beautiful. That's beautiful what you said. We have to name things as they are. We are on the metaphysical attack. The devil hates the woman, and the devil hates her offspring. In the Christian world, we believe in that there is a fight for our souls and a fight for our families. But if you use the means that your faith gives you, then you have already won. And we are not because we are strong, but because we are redeemed. We're redeemed by the blood of Christ who died for us. That's our only hope. It's not our doing. It's not the brilliant ideas that we have to save the world. It's Christ has died for us. He has saved us. We don't do anything. So, yeah, I'm full of hope because of that, not because a brilliant plan that we have.
Edward Habsburg, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much. The book is called The Habsburg Way. You can get it from Amazon or, better still, a local bookseller if you are so inclined. Edward, thank you. God bless you. It's been lovely to talk.
Thank you very much, and hear you soon again.